Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Okay, what is the connection between crawling through a jungle and your to-do list? What can ejecting out of a stealth bomber teach you about the importance of thinking the worst? Hopefully, we're going to find the answers. A brilliant new book called How to Survive by John Hudson. He joins us now. Morning, John.
Morning, Bill. How are you?
Very good, sir. Very good. And delighted to talk to you and an ex-RAF man.
Likewise, yeah.
I'm a pilot, but not an RAF one. So I'm fascinated that you're a helicopter man, aren't you?
I was. I finished flying some time ago, and I've spent the rest of my RAF time in the reserves teaching survival. But it's a kind of a full time job, as you can imagine.
Oh, absolutely. So, how was it in the RAF flying helicopters? Must have been great fun.
Oh, it was brilliant. Yeah, it was a good time of life. That great friends, great job. Saw a little bit of the world, yeah. It was exciting and, you know, hopefully quite useful to some people, yeah.
Good. Absolutely. It's very odd because I flew and still do fly light aircraft for years, but I have a fear of heights. So if I'm on a balcony or something like that, then I'm dreadfully, dreadfully scared, but not on a plane. But I am in a helicopter. I find that the same
really?
Kind of feeling. I think it must be the looking down thing.
It is a bit, and then you're actually not in the minority of that thing. A lot of the guys I went through flying training with had a kind of a similar appreciation of the realities of gravity.
Isn't that, like that. That's a good way to put it. So I'm not scared of heights, I have an appreciation of gravity. I love that.
Yeah.
It sounds a little less severe. Love it.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So this book then really is taking what you teach other people, but you're a teacher of teachers, aren't you, effectively?
Yeah, that's right, Bill, yeah.
Yeah, and so this is to take the lessons that you're teaching and apply them to us poor mortals.
I think it applies to everybody, regardless of what you do. The stuff that we train the trainers to do, as you know from your flying time, there's quite a lot going on in your head when you sit in an aeroplane.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you've got all the procedures that air traffic demand from you. You've got all the stuff to do with flying the aeroplane, navigating the aeroplane, avoiding bad weather, all that kind of stuff. And the guys that we ultimately train are doing that in very, very fast aeroplanes, but they're also, you know, they're doing that while other people are trying to knock them out of the sky. So they've got all that going on as well. So they've got incredibly busy day jobs.
Yeah.
And the stuff that we're teaching them is kind of an insurance policy for their worst ever day out. You know, nobody wants to get shut down. We hope that we've done enough to prevent that happening, but the unfortunate reality of kind of aviation is even the aeroplane itself could fail for no fault of your own, or someone could actively pursue your kind of interaction with gravity, as we were just talking about. So what we teach them is what to do if the worst happens, and that applies everywhere. And the good thing, I think, Bill, about the way that we train military aviators and other members of the armed forces is because they've got such busy brains and so much to remember, what we train them to do has to be really simple. Has to be the most boiled down, simplistic way of preventing the worst happening that it can be.
That's really interesting. So you are basically preparing for the worst then?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a multitude of contexts. As you know from flying the light aircraft, you know, in the space of 10, 30 minutes, you can cover a huge amount of distance. And then some of the guys that we train, they could be on the other side of the planet between taking off and landing. So they can cover all kinds of different environments. So whilst bushcraft is a brilliant hobby for people who want to take an interest in the outdoors, it would be absolutely impossible to make the guys that we're training good at the bushcraft of the different indigenous people around the world. It's a mammoth task in itself, a lifetime's work, and even the experts on telly can't hold their hands up and say they've mastered everywhere. So what we teach is an overlying skills, like a procedure almost, that you can overlay onto any environment and it still holds up. And it simplifies things.
I was lucky enough to talk not that long ago, actually, to John Nicol, who was, along with John Peters, of course, shot down during the Gulf War and captured.
Yeah.
He would be exactly the kind of guy that you'd be trying to teach, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit behind John in the sort of the career path of the Royal Air Force. He was in the Air Force about 10, 15 years before me, but it's exactly the same kind of stuff. It's exactly the same cohort of people, like guys and girls these days, who are going away, and we're teaching them for those exact eventualities. So be it a desert, a jungle, or these modern days, an urban environment, how to stay alive and get rescued. And when you look at what underlies that, it actually maps onto our everyday lives as well. And I've certainly used it day to day as a kind of a guiding principle, rather than, you know, not so much thinking about the common idea of what survival is, which is probably what people have seen on TV, where people are rubbing sticks together and all that kind of stuff. It's not that. It's like being pragmatic, having the right mindset, importantly, because it all begins with where your mind's at. Loads of stuff on how to prepare your brain, and then a little bit of fundamental skills that you can apply. And I think, and I said it in the book, you can apply it equally to crawling through a jungle or your to-do list at work. It's the same stuff that underlies it all.
Hey, so I'm just remembering here as well, I interviewed again recently somebody whose father was very much involved in that, and that was Gary Powers, who was the pilot behind the U-2 incident back in 1960. Now, he, of course, was flying the U-2 spy plane, and he was shot down at rather bizarrely, because he never thought he could even see the plane, and he had trouble getting out of the aircraft. And of course, then he lands in hostile territory, and he had with him, you know, the phial of poison to take, so that if he was captured, he wouldn't give any secrets away. I mean, that's serious business, isn't it?
Wow, yeah, that's pretty A-level stuff, isn't it? Back when the Cold War was hot. You speak to some interesting people, Bill.
Well, and also your good self, sir. I mean, I just thought it was an interesting comparison, because they are people, you know, who are kind of who are faced with that very thing that you're teaching people to do.
And that's a really interesting parallel, actually, because one of the guys that I liaise really closely with for the first chapter is a guy called Dale Zelko, and I was just texting him this morning, actually. But Dale was shot down over Serbia in 1999. It was 20 years ago this March that he was shot down.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing that you mentioned there, where Gary thought that his aircraft couldn't be seen. Now, Dale is acutely aware that the stealth bomber he was flying is actually just described within his community as low observable. But the media and the greater good of us guys on the street, we thought stealth bombers were invisible, but they're not. So the night that Dale was flying to bomb targets in the former Yugoslavia to bring about the end of that conflict over there, he was wearing three pairs of socks. And as you can imagine, like the cockpit of a modern jet is actually fairly comfortable. It's a managed environment. But he had three pairs of socks on. He had extra water in his pockets. He had snack bars in his pockets. He'd eaten extra complex carbohydrates before he took off to give him a slow energy release. And importantly, he was actively thinking every time he took off about what he would do if he was shot down, even though he was in cutting edge, billions of dollars worth of stealth bomber.
Amazing.
He was thinking about what would happen if the worst came about. And because his brain was so well prepared, and the world did not expect this to happen, but Dale knew it was a possibility, even though it was a vanishingly small possibility, he knew that this could happen because he'd prepared his mind. When he actually got shot down, within seconds of ejecting out of that aircraft in the dark sky, he pulled his radio out of his pocket under the parachute and started talking to fellow pilots.
Wow.
And that's why he got rescued from behind enemy lines, because he was so far in front of events, because he thought about what the worst could be, that he knew exactly what to do.
Interesting. And that's a state of mind, isn't it?
Exactly, Bill. That's what it is. It's preparing your brain. And all the good stuff that Dale had done, and he is kind of your best example of good practice in these scenarios, all the good stuff he'd done, we can do ourselves in our day-to-day. We really can.
It almost reminds me of when you kind of, particularly here in Spain, and people know I moan about this all the time, you take your life in your hands when you drive on some of the roads here. And my state of mind always is, when I'm driving, whether it's here or anywhere else, somebody near me is going to do something really stupid.
Well, yeah, expect the worst and you won't be disappointed, probably.
Yes, I'm really disappointed, believe me, here, yeah. is there an answer if there's one thing that you would need to survive, to have with you, that you would carry around for life, what would that be? Would it be a first aid kit or something?
So there's two answers to that, I reckon, Bill. And one of them is kind of, it's not meant to sound glib at all, but one of them is a well-stocked brain.
Yeah.
We've all got a ton of latent capacity that we just don't normally access. Because one of the things that I've found over the years of training individuals and training instructors and practically doing it myself, you know, when I've been and done some of the survival TV stuff too, and you're putting yourself out there to fall over almost, that the hardest thing to do in those situations when the worst is happening all around you and you wake up in the night and it started to snow and you're living under a bush is just to keep going. But there's a hack for that. So a well-stocked brain. So the key thing, so part one of the answer, the sort of the psychological part to the what to carry with you, is the knowledge that we can all do more than we think we can do.
Yeah.
And there are great examples from aviation and from, you know, other realms of exploration about that. But the key part to that is when people give up, and people do, when they give up, it's because they feel hopeless. They've lost hope. People will lose hope if they're suffering, but it's not just suffering alone that causes a feeling of hopelessness. What psychologists who are far brighter than me have discovered in laboratory tests is that we lose hope when we're suffering, and the suffering that we have, we feel like we can't control it.
Right.
So if you feel like you can't control your suffering, you're likely to give up hope. Now, you flip that over and say, right, okay, how can I gain a feeling of control over my suffering? And the simple answer, mate, is to stop your brain with the quick one-liner that as long as I do something to improve my situation, I will feel like I control my suffering,
yes,
and therefore my hope perseveres. And I've kind of come up with my epiphany when I was doing this writing, was I've come up with, I've just called it to myself, a survival triangle, but it's kind of a perseverance engine. You know that you've got something you can do, you do it, the environment gets slightly better, you keep going, and it maintains hope, and it just keeps that flywheel in your brain spinning. And I've used it loads in extreme environments, and the worst thing for me, mate, is emails. So my inbox is just a torrent of stuff like everyone else's is. And I use that to get through all those things. And then I suppose the other part to answer your question about what practical stuff people could carry, I think the best thing that people could carry is a decent first aid kit.
Yeah.
And that's the first line of defense in any kind of survival situation. But it's no use to you if you don't know how to use it. So the best advice I can give to anybody, if they want to get some practical, good, hands-on training, is not necessarily to walk out into the woods and learn how to light fires, because that's brilliant, but to get some good first aid training before any of that other stuff.
Interesting. What about technology? When I was in the Boy Scouts, we used to, we used to get a badge for map reading and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I had those little Clark's tracker shoes with a compass in the bottom of them. I don't know if you remember those.
How do you read your compass when you're actually walking?
Well, you have to take the shoe off. That was the only problem. Yeah. So your foot froze and you lost your foot, but you knew where you were.
Yeah, exactly. Where's North Britain?
What about technology? I mean, people now who would get lost, I would imagine, would get their phones out and go, oh, hey, here I am. It's obvious now. I'll just follow Google Maps and I'll be home in 5 minutes. Is that a good thing?
Well, so there's a real body of evidence building to say that parts of our brains are atrophying because we're over-reliant on navigation technology. Now, I'm not a Luddite, mate. I love technology,
sure,
but in the right places. I think with all of these kinds of contexts, there's a bit of pragmatism, and you have to have a kind of what I would call a layered approach. So one of the best people you could speak to about navigating without a map or compass in the world is a friend of mine called Tristan Gooley. I don't know if you've spoken to him before.
No.
Oh, right, so you need Tristan on your show, mate.
Oh,
he's awesome. He's called online as the Natural Navigator, but what a lovely bloke. And he'll explain all this far better than I can. So there are clues in nature, which I use, and I've worked with Tristan on this as well at our school. So you can navigate without your phone. You can obviously navigate using a map and compass. But the thing with your phone is it's got that plethora of uses, and it's a shame to burn all of its energy, all its battery power in a dodgy situation, using it to navigate when you could do something else that's a little bit easier.
Right.
Because then you can save your phone for what it's really good at, which is communicating early to others if you are in a tight spot.
Yes.
And do you know who people always ring when they have an emergency, Bill?
Go on.
Their dads. So this is proven time and again from people who've ejected over enemy territory through to people who've capsized a canoe in the, you know, in the wash. So what you can do is not just preload your brain, but preload a good number into your phone for someone to ring, so you don't stress your parents out.
That's a really good idea. And in fact, I think Apple, for example, make that easier. They have an emergency contact that you can press the button several times, and it will immediately ring that emergency contact.
Yeah, exactly. And there's also that little hack that quite a lot of people know these days of dialing 112, because most countries, not all, but most countries, if you dial 999, you won't get through.
Yeah.
But if you're abroad and you have a problem, dial 112, you can normally get patched through to emergency services.
Well, it's a good job I didn't ever have to rely on my dad in an emergency when he was alive, because he'd been in the pub on the floor drunk, so it'd have been pointless, been absolutely pointless ringing him, I tell you. And now, what about people? We're on the coast here, and a lot of people do boating. A lot of people go swimming when they come on holidays here.
Yeah.
I imagine that water is a particular danger, and one that wouldn't immediately be that obvious, that you don't need to be in that cold of water to be in trouble.
You are absolutely spot on, Bill. So the whole school that I'm a part of, it was born out of that precise scenario. During the Battle of Britain, back in 1940, 8 out of 10 pilots who bailed out over the English Channel were never seen again. And the reason was because the water was cold. You know, it doesn't have to be that cold, like you say, before you start to cool down, you eventually fall unconscious, and then there's nothing you can do. So wear flotation aids. Look at something like Mike Tipton, the RNLI's campaign about float. Know that you've got to fight that instinct to try and swim. You've got to lie on your back and let your breathing regulate. And a little bit of knowledge, just like we've spoken about with the other stuff,
yeah,
really empowering there. Yeah, definitely.
I was thinking back, I mean, I think in the end there was some kind of, it was either foul play or there was some alcohol involved. But I remember reading recently of the woman who fell off the back of a cruise liner. Can you imagine what went through her mind as she hit the water and saw ship disappearing, you know, in front of her? Panic.
It must be awful.
Absolute panic.
It must be awful.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what a lot of people who are slightly better placed than somebody who's floating. So people in life rafts or lifeboats of old would normally find that if people were going to have a psychological collapse, and they did, it would be if a ship looked like it had seen them but just carried on and crossed the horizon and disappeared. Yeah, because that must be crushing.
Oh, dear. And now, for those who are a little more adventurous and they go, and a lot of that happens around here, go hiking up mountains and all the rest of it, are there particular things that we should be wearing or not be wearing, depending on where we're walking?
Yeah, that's good. So it depends on where you are and the time of year. Cotton, at the wrong time of year in the wrong place, is a killer. Now, that's been known to some parts of the armed forces for a long time, but it first came out in a study in the 60s after there were 3 deaths on in the UK during a little Peak District rambling exercise. And what they discovered was the young lads who died were very fit, but they were lost and sort of stuck by bad weather. And they got one of the guy's kit, and he was wearing jeans and a cotton t-shirt, and they put a volunteer in his exact outfit and measured his thermal properties. And what they discovered is over 80% of the insulation is lost out of cotton when it's wet.
Good grief.
So if it's raining and windy, it's tragic. You know, it will suck the heat out of you. And the flip side to that would be if you're in a really hot place, cotton's good. But most of us, if we're having difficulties, it's sort of getting towards the end of the day, the temperature's dropping off. If we've been flapping or sweating a lot, our clothes will be wet, and that's when it's a danger. So the short answer to that is the best fabric to wear in cold and wet, or in any kind of situation where you're going to be maybe sweating a lot, is actually wool. So you want to be wearing something like merino wool. And they make some excellent base layers now, because wool will maintain its insulative properties even when it's wet.
So the sheep aren't as stupid as they look then, basically?
No, they're smug and warm, yeah.
That's very interesting. So would it be said then, if it was a wet and windy day and you were wearing cotton, would it actually be better to take it off?
Depends. So if the cotton is wet and you're able to get out of the weather, then yes. If you're stationary, if you're stuck, then yeah, take the wet clothing off and get into something like a plastic bag.
But if
you know, it's a mixed message, this. So probably best thing to do, get yourself into your survival bag straight away. Some heat will be retained in there. What you need to do is get the cotton out of the wind. So if you've got a way to get shelter, get into dry clothing. That would be the answer, if you had it.
Okay, food. Now, there's a lot of people on the TV who can boast about all these great things that we can do when we're out and we get stuck in the wild. But what's the actual truth of this? I mean, should we be running around trying to catch fish and rabbits, or is there an alternative?
I know, it makes great telly, though, doesn't
it? Yes, it does, it does.
And the problem with great telly is it just gets repeated, because it's... And telly, as you know, as a friend of mine in the TV production industry, I should add, once told me, is TV is just the stuff between the adverts, and how true that is. But unfortunately, reality isn't quite as glamorous as the telly, and we can survive for an incredible amount of time without eating. It's weeks, not days, that we can survive without eating. And most of us, and I include myself in this demographic, have got a little bit of extra reserves around our bodies.
Yes,
you know, we've got a little bit of supplies on us. So the way to look at anything, and this applies to every day as well as survival, is what's going to harm me first?
Yep.
And like I said earlier, first aid. If you don't know how to stop a friend or a relative who's cut themselves from bleeding, then you're in a really bad place.
Yeah.
So no first aid. We've spoken a little bit about clothing because temperature will harm you next. And then after that, we're looking at, well, actually, we really just need to get rescued. So the next thing to do is to try and get help.
Yeah.
Once you get past that, you're actually going to dehydrate far faster than you're going to starve.
Right.
So you could, in the wrong kind of part of the world, you could become dehydrated and ineffective in hours or even days.
Interesting.
But then food, to answer the exact question, food is a massively low priority. And then when you look at how to get food, I mean, most of us who've grown up in the UK know nettles because we've played football or played in the park and we've been stung by them.
Yeah.
So if you can positively identify something like a nettle, which is 100% edible, you can eat those, they've got great protein value in them, then you don't need to run around in circles chasing animals that are better at running away than you are at catching. So yeah, to answer the question and dispel a few TV survival myths, protein in the form of animals and fish is way down the line. But that's where kind of the boundary between bushcraft and survival gets blurred a bit, Bill, and you see a little bit of the bushcraft wash over. So, yeah, pure survival terms, don't go chasing animals. Just carry an extra snack bar like Dale Zelko did.
So running along Fuengirola Beach with a spear to catch a fish is not maybe your best first option, then?
It's quite exciting, but no, it's not.
I love it. Well, it's been fabulous to talk to you. I mean, some great tips in there, and there's many, many more in the book, How to Survive. I guess that the thing that you're trying to get across here is don't walk around in the world being paranoid that something is going to happen to you, but on the other hand, don't think that you're going to go through life with nothing happening to you.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a life-threatening wilderness-type thing. It could be an email that changes your world. It could be something in your career that you want to improve.
Yeah.
You can apply these principles, and knowing that you can improve your performance and our brains are just as malleable and as adaptable as our bodies is the key. We can all perform better in a multitude of scenarios.
Fantastic. Multitasking.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's another topic itself.
It certainly is, and we're not going to get into the men and women argument on that one, are we? No, we'll leave that one, John.
Don't hear it.
Brilliant. How to Survive is the book. John Hudson, great to talk to you. Have a great day.
Likewise.
All the best.
Thanks,
John.
Very much.
Cheers then.
On.
Bye-bye.